strength side of things, or more on the strength and hope side of things than I might have. But I've been at ACA for a little over 2.5 years, and so I was asked by Mary to do the speakers meeting, and I don't know whether she asked because there was an empty slot or because she thought I might have something interesting to say or what, but I think I'm probably just at some level just an interesting novice at this. So I wanted to read something. I wanted to read today's reading, actually, from Strengthening My Recovery, because it seems relevant. It talks about Tradition 5. And they say, when carrying the ACA message, we stick to our story and to the principles of recovery. We don't proselytize, bully, evangelize, or manipulate the person we are attempting to help. So that blew my talk as soon as I saw that this morning. The focus of a single purpose guarantees that we are never going to be distracted by other tempting, glittery objects. We do one thing only. We carry the message to the adult child who still suffers. So I did look up what a speaker is supposed to speak about, and that's in the Big Red Book. I get really bored when people read ACA stuff, but I think it's my rebellion as a kid. I didn't like teachers reading to me what I had already read or what I could read it on myself, on my own. But on page 572 of the Big Red Book, it says, suggestions for ACA speakers and lead shares. When asked to speak at a group, convention, or other ACA event, we are expected to share our life story before finding recovery and what has happened since finding recovery. The key to speaking at an ACA meeting involves balancing your remarks with an equal amount of family dysfunctional history, living codependently or addictively as an adult, and living life in recovery with the 12 steps, sponsorship, and ACA meeting attendance. Each part is important. So I will try to do that tonight. And I'm going to start with a quote. So this is a quote. I'm a songwriter. I'm going to quote some of my own songs as I go through, my maybe just three of them and not the whole song, just short quotes, just to give a sense of where I was at different points during this journey. So this is from a song called Sweet to Me. It starts off, long as I remember, I've been burning inside. I'm trying to learn to fly. My daddy told me I was born to fail. He never told me why. If things are bad, I can make them worse. I tied my pony to the back of the hearse. Of everything I wanted, there was never enough. Oh, I kicked and screamed and cursed. So that's where I started off my ACA journey, was a very sharp awareness of my limitations, of the cage that I was living in as a human being. And so my family is where I got a lot of that from. My dad, I was a second child. I was born in Japan. My dad was a military physician. And so my brother was 2.5 years older than me. And I think that's kind of significant. I think being a younger child is easier. The older child, their peer group is their parents. And so I had this brother that I could look to as a reference. We lived in Japan for another 6 weeks, and then we came back to the U.S., so I don't have a lot of memories of Japan. And my first memory of being alive, literally, was as a child watching my father come up the steps towards my brother and I, who were waiting for punishment of some sort in his room, and wishing that he were dead. So that's kind of where my whole relationship with life started, was an understanding that I was very scared of and hated my father. I think now, after having gone through the 12 steps in ACA, I feel like I can now honor my father. I don't have that same sense of foreboding with him. I spent the last 40 years of my life trying to exorcise that demon that was my father. And that never worked. It got better, but it never really worked. I thought at one point that I had reached the understanding that it was a little bit like the boy named Sue condition, where my father had set me up for failure intentionally so that I would learn something and be better at life because of it, because he didn't have the skills or the tools maybe to give me in a direct way. But looking back, I just don't think he was like that at all. I think he was just malicious and angry and literally wanted to damage his two sons. as best he could. And he worked at that until his death. So my dad was a physician, as I said. He was on 24/7, 365 days a year, my entire life. I remember him drinking heavily and answering the phone when an intern would call. He was a pediatric cardiologist, so he's taking care of infants who are in the womb or just out of the womb. And he's answering phone calls, dead drunk in the middle of the night, and giving prescriptions over the phone, talking to interns through complicated procedures, going in early to do surgeries. I would say he was a high-functioning alcoholic. My mother seemed along for the ride, so they both would finish off a full handle of vodka every night between the two of them, and a pack of cigarettes, and watch TV. And that was just kind of our life. We didn't go out much. We didn't have a lot of friends. My memory of growing up with friends was we moved a lot because my dad was still in school while I was growing up. And so I generally had one friend maybe. Rarely did I have two friends. So I was always a jealous kid that, I didn't get to do sports. Just wasn't in our family to do that stuff. So I was just this jealous, angry, quiet kid, very isolated, and my brother was a little bit better off. He had friends, he played music, but I just was along for the ride, and was basically fighting with my dad from the first time I remember anything. I was in a battle with my father for control or for attention, and I think what I ended up coming out of the family with was a feeling of wanting to exact revenge on my family and wanting to show them that I could be successful in the world or I could accomplish something in the world, but very quickly realizing when I was on my own that I had no tools to do that with. As going through ACA, I just wanted to sort of talk about the family for a little bit still, but going through ACA, I was still all about my father. I was all about this vengeful relationship, this person who manipulated me and controlled me for many years after I left home. So he would do things like when I asked for a loan at one point, when we had my first kid, I bought a house in Santa Barbara, and I asked them if I could get a loan from them, and he sent me a letter, which I think I still have someplace, which basically detailed all the things I would need to do to get this loan from him. He opened the letter with, "I know you'll never pay me back, but because you don't pay back your debts," and then said, "You need to give me a daily call and tell me about your marriage relationship. You need to tell me about your exercise, your diet. You basically need to tell me about your entire life every day and give me a report on what you're doing in order to get this loan." I didn't take the loan, and we made it through. But through ACA, I did get to this point of, I did a genealogy of the family. I went back up the family tree. I didn't really find a lot in his family, but I did, when I started looking at family photos, find that there was this gap. So when he was born and for the first 4 years of his life, there was tons of photos. Then his sister was born and there were three photos, and then no photos again until he was 20. And then he was out on his own. He had a horse and they took photos of him with his horse. So I think my guess is his mother went through some kind of postpartum depression that they couldn't talk about in the family, and that then poisoned the family and his childhood. And I don't really have any other information about what he went through. On my mother's side, her grandmother moved in with them when she was 2 and lived with them until she was 12 and was this very angry, controlling person up in the attic loft area, and would come downstairs and abuse her when her parents were gone, not physically, but verbally and manipulatively abuse her when her parents were gone. And so they both kind of had, they're both dysfunctional, but not highly dysfunctional. And then they came into this family together, and I think they both liked isolation. They both liked their privacy. They both liked their personal time. And so my memory of my father was never around, and when he was around, he was the controlling, angry disciplinarian. But my memory of my mother was basically I'd come home from school or I'd be looking for her, and her my memory of her is just this. She was on the phone and she'd snap at me and tell me to be quiet because she was busy with her friends. She said she did a lot of bridge and bowling. So I come out of that house, that childhood, and I in ACA, like I said, I tried to get through the process of forgiving my family and my father, mostly my father. And as I got through that process, my mother went into hospice and began her process of dying. And this was last year. She died December 31st of last year. And in that process, we had a lot of conversations about my father and a lot of conversations about the family. And I began to realize what a large part she had played. So I had occasionally, as a child, had these moments when I realized, like, I could use some backup here. I could use some level of justification from somebody that I'm okay, or that I'm not insane, or that what's happening to me is not what should be happening. And I had depended on my mother for that. And occasionally there was signs that she would support me. But then when it got right down to it, when it was like a big issue, when I was definitely in trouble, she would side with my father. And I realized that there was a lot in her life of, I think possibly that my father was too much for her to feel like she could stand up to him. But also she wanted a less complicated life than maybe what her two kids would bring if they had full expression and feelings and all that stuff like people might have if they're human. She kind of abdicated. She backed off. She was not really available. And I didn't really understand that because my father was the enemy. I didn't understand that till later. And so that was a great realization that came out of this program for me. When I was 13, I joined a book club. And I joined it as a paperback book club, and they'd send you sets. So you always got sets of stuff. I think I bought sets because that's the best value. You'd pay like $15 and get 3 books instead of pay $15 and get 1 book. And so I got things like Kurt Vonnegut, Richard Brautigan. I got a book about yoga. I got 3 books about yoga. I got the first 3 Carlos Castaneda books. And it was, for a 13-year-old, this was like crazy. It was amazing. We just moved from Los Angeles. We lived in downtown Hollywood. We moved from Los Angeles, where I'd been introduced to drugs and porn and all sorts of stuff. Murder. One of my classmates was murdered after a track meet there. It was crazy times. But we moved from there. We moved to Redlands, California, which was a very conservative, kind of quiet place. And I got started reading these books and doing yoga and taking drugs more intentionally along the Carlos Castaneda line of things, peyote and LSD, and kind of popping my mind open. And that began a lifetime of self-therapy, and then also other therapies later on. So I knew that I was banged up and messed up by that point. I knew that, like, I had had a sense even in kindergarten that when I was hanging out with other kids, that there was a barrier between myself and them. And I now look at it like I felt like I was looking through a store window at something, like some event that was happening and everyone's having fun, and I just couldn't get through the glass. I couldn't ever figure out how to get through that store window. And I couldn't get feedback from people. Like, I don't know how it's been for other people in ACA, but before I hit ACA, I could just never get... I was hungry for just somebody to tell me what I was doing that was so offensive to them. Like, I'd make friends, I'd hang out with people, I'd have a couple coffees, and then all of a sudden they're acting like, I don't want to be around this guy. I now know I complained all the time. I judged everything. I was just I could only talk about myself. I had my goals, and that was it. I measured everything by how I was doing. I was boring, and I was horrible. I was an asshole. I now know that, but I didn't know that then. I thought, you know, like, I could just get somebody to tell me what was going on, and I'm sure if anyone I asked that of, they were like, I'm not going to talk to you because you're an asshole. So so I didn't get much feedback. But I did start this self-therapy aspect knowing that I was messed up. So I started reading all this stuff, doing the yoga, and I got into, in college, I went into ESC, which I don't know, a lot of people, like, I thought everybody knew what it was, but I've asked people recently and they don't. So this was like a thing where you go into a hotel ballroom with 200 other people, and there's one presenter, a trainer, and you're in there for two full weekends for the main program, and they basically, the message was, you know, get over your fears and just live your life. And they were, you know, they broke through a lot of people's barriers, and it was an interesting therapeutic process. I was in that program for 5 years. I learned a lot, but it was all still in what I would call the cage of myself. I still had the same fears, the same behaviors, the same traits. Everything was the same. I went from there into a program called Conversation Toward Autonomy, which was this very esoteric but structured therapy program to basically become a citizen, an aware, responsible human citizen in the world that was able to achieve goals and make money and do all the normal things. And I needed that badly. It gave me a lot of skills. I was able to write books based on that. I was able to make plans and execute on my plans and have a family and get raises and do all the things that people do in their lives when they do normal stuff. I was able to look normal for the first time in my life. But those things, when I, each of them kind of fell apart because the people that were offering them were, one of them was arrested for tax evasion, and there was some weird shit going on in his family. And the other one, when I got together with my current wife, she showed me some research that she'd done online about the guy, and he was like a real squirrely guy. He had some weird stuff going on. And so I'm doing this therapy with these people who were a little bit charlatans. And I got a lot out of it, like I said. I don't have any complaints. But I didn't have, I was still in the cage of myself. I did not have any sense of progress. I still understood, like, I would go through these things and all I would do with them is increase the pressure. I would get better basically at being a goal-driven, frightened animal. So if I'm like I often have this image of myself as starting off as this little succulent inside a bell jar and just growing out to the limits, and then just everything I learned, it was like a fractal program. I just pushed and pushed and pushed, and I was filling this jar to the max, and I would go learn something else, and I'd figure out how to fill it even further. And I was just expanding exponentially in a tiny space, and I felt like I was going to explode, and I did occasionally. So cut back a few years. I got married when I was 29, I think. I got married at a point when I was just tired of dating. I was tired of being myself in a lot of ways. I wanted just to do something where I could just give up on a lot of that efforting. So I married somebody who I literally said, I'm not in love, but I think I can talk to this person when I'm old. And then we had two kids. And the kids were amazing. My children are the best thing I ever did. They're amazing. I love them. And that marriage did not last a long time, maybe 10 years. And she turned out to be very much like my father. And it dawned on me one Thanksgiving dinner when we're sitting down with my parents and her and our kids, and my father and her talking. We lived in Santa Barbara. My parents lived in Redlands still. And they're talking, and they both are seeing a physician in L.A., for ailments, two different ailments, but they're both on the same medications and the same dosages. And it just like hit me that these two people were physically, very physically similar, and also just very similar in, like, they were, it was like as if I'd been a rock in a river and I'd been stuck in a like a perfectly shaped little bowl in another rock. A flood had come along and washed me into another hole in the same shape and size that I'd been in before. So it's like a perfect fit. And that perfect fit was abuse, manipulation, control, anger, was all that stuff, and it was just embedded in my marriage. We were seeing a counselor at the time, and the counselor said, I'm retiring, and I've never said this to anybody, but your wife hates you. Like, you should leave this marriage. So I left the marriage and met my current wife, and that was a huge, wonderful gift to me, but I'll get to that in a minute. So in this realm of self-therapy as an addictive, codependent adult, and knowing that I needed to break out of whatever cage I was in, I did things like I took improv classes to break up this persona so I could just try to learn to play and perform in front of people, because I was so shut down emotionally, so embarrassed to speak in front of people. I did public speaking. I joined boards. I took all sorts of classes. I was a nighttime counselor on a helpline during college. I did stuff that forced me to be somebody that I wasn't, so that I could at least maybe get outside the cage and look back at it. I don't think I ever got outside the cage, never, until I got to ACA. Just want to see if there's anything I wanted to cover elsewhere. Oh, I want to do another quote here. So during this period, I reached this point at which I began to understand that I just wanted to shut my brain off because it was not doing me any service. So this is just a short one. From a song called Sweet Lunacy. Just want to stop the chitter chatter, feel the breeze play through, find my way to Jacob's ladder, and only be as real as I am true. And that was a big thing for me to understand that reality and truth, I knew them as two very distinct things, and I lied for the first 30 years of my life. One of those programs, the Conversation Toward Autonomy, did teach me that being honest was a useful thing. It had a whole amends process involved. I went and cleaned up a bunch of lies. I used to steal stuff from my brother's band when I was a kid. I stole records. I went back and paid things back. I went back and apologized. It was so hard. And I learned to apologize for things I said in real time. And it got me to at least begin telling the truth to others, if not to myself. So that was a huge step for me. But it was still, I was still in my cage. I came to ACA through a recovery book by Russell Brand. If that's his name, right? Russell Brand, the comedian guy. He wrote a book called Recovery, and my wife and I were both were good drinkers. I had my six shots of whiskey a night. I had graduated to nice whiskeys, you know, because I had the money. I could do that at that point in my life. She drank her vodkas every night and capped it at, I think it was four shots or something. Beyond that, she'd be drunk and it would be a bad day the next day. And for me, beyond my six, it would be a bad day the next day. So we just lived this life of drinking, eating on the couch and watching television. And that was pretty much our home life. And the kids were all in school or out on their own. And so that's just kind of where we were, with the understanding that we did want to stop someday and that day would come. So Russell Brand comes out with this book. I saw a couple of interviews with him, like on Stephen Colbert, things like that. And I didn't know it was a 12-step book. My daughter had been through the 12-step AA program and had gone through the rehab program at Cottage twice for drinking. And so I'd done some AA work with her. I'd done some 12-step work with her. I'd been to meetings with her, but I didn't trust the 12 steps. I didn't understand them. I saw them as a weird, I was an atheist, so I saw them as a weird religious kind of back door that was unnecessary, that was superstitious, that was, I mean, like, I felt like if you just cut down the your sugar intake, you could deal with your alcohol, blah, 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 all this stuff. So so that book comes along, and I showed it to my wife, and she said, well, let's read it. So we started reading it. She came out, like, a couple hours later and said, I'm going to AA. So she went to AA. I went to AA. I was not really, I mean, I drank a lot, but I was not an alcoholic. I just stopped. Anytime I wanted to stop in my life, I just stopped. And so I just stopped drinking alcohol at that point. We both stopped at that point. So I didn't feel like an alcoholic. I went to Al-Anon. I felt like that was, the meetings that I went to, it felt like it was focused on the other person. It was focused on the partner. And my wife and I have always been in, I don't want to say lockstep, but we're both willing to adapt, and we're both willing to change. And we were both going through the same change at the same time in recovery. And so from Al-Anon, I then heard about ACA, and I went to an ACA meeting. It was like November 22nd or something of 2017. And at that meeting, the things that stood out to me were the traits. It was the first time in all this therapy in all my life that I had seen a description of the cage. Like, that was my cage. Those traits were the cage that I was sitting in. I was up against the walls. I had been at the bottom, I think, for basically 30 years, like, aware of that I was a piece of shit, aware that I didn't deserve what I had in my life. Like, one of the things about having kids for me was, in all relationships in my life, I could always just walk away. And that's what I did. I walked away from relationships, or I could threaten to walk away. But when you have kids, that's a relationship that you care about. And so I could read in my children's faces and in their behavior that they did not respect me, that they did not like me, that they did not want to be around me. And there were times when it was worse, when they really didn't want to be around me. And so I had that information. So I had been at the bottom for decades and looking for something and never looking. I never wanted to look at something free or that just anybody could do. It always had to be special because my goals, when I see friends, I reported out my goals and how I was doing on them. It always had to be important. It always had to be the next thing. It always had to be progress. It was, I had to have this cadence in my life. So I hit ACA. It's none of the things I expected it to be. Those 14 traits, at first, I the first day I looked at them, I thought maybe I had seven. Within a week, I had all 14 for sure. And now I don't see a distinction between them and me at all. I am those traits. I am integrating them. I am lessening them. But those traits are me. The other thing that struck me was, in all my therapy stuff, even in my phone counseling, I had been trained. I had actually led a workshop called the Communication Workshop. I talked to people. I trained on it. I had gotten hours of effort on learning how to listen, and I had never gotten it. My form of listening was, I now call it the rubber band method, which was, I would start listening, and I would stretch this rubber band. Normally, I'd jump in after 10 seconds. Somebody starts talking, and I give them advice, or I jump in with my, oh, that reminds me, or whatever, within 10 seconds. So I take listening classes, and I'd stretch my rubber band, and it would be like out to 15 seconds or 20 seconds. And that was a big deal for me. And then it would be like I'd jump in. But that's a rubber band. It's like a lot of tension there. So the farther you stretch, the more tension there is, and the more I needed to interrupt and have my say and, you know, and be, you know, the force in the conversation, be the important one in the conversation. I sat through that first ACA meeting, and I just got that, like, listening was listening, like, truly allowing another person to be and express themselves and just be themselves. And I had a sense of those people in the room. that I'd never had anywhere else I'd been in my life. I wasn't paying attention to anybody else. And I walked out of that meeting and I said, I will listen to my daughters for 5 minutes. I will listen to my boss for 5 minutes. I'll listen to my wife for 5 minutes and see what happens. And that started a process for me that has been just growing and improving every single day. So the best example is with my youngest daughter, who was the one who showed the greatest disdain for me through the divorce and through all the stuff that went on after. She was the most put together. She's a grad student at Duke right now. She's studying palliative care policy. I don't know. She's an impressive kid. But she shares my birthday, and so for her to disdain me was heartbreaking. And there was at one point I had to spend their college money. The divorce, you know, went through a couple waves of financial hell. I had to spend the money that had been set aside for their college to pay debt and to get us out of a bind. And at that point, when I told her that I'd done that, she stopped talking to me. And that lasted for a little while. And then she just kicked back in talking to me again. Once a week on the phone, she found a way to talk to her father, even though I hadn't gone through any appreciable change. Then with ACA, I started talking to her. I started to think about our phone calls. And so each time I would call her, I would have questions for her about her life. And I started it with logistical stuff. You know, what are you doing? What classes do you have? I'd write this stuff down so the next time I could ask about those classes and the teachers. And then I'd start asking about the other students. And so I just started building this model in my head. And then there was another big shift when I was able to shift and say, what is it that she was interested in these things? What drove her? What made her alive with these things? And then another huge shift very recently when it just all of a sudden popped into this. It was like not planned. It was not, I didn't have notes. It was just a conversation. For the first time in my life, I had a conversation with my daughter. Excuse me. And my oldest daughter, too, then also some disdain for her father, but support was more supportive of me. And then when my mother was going through her hospice, I was being my same old self, you know, like, how can we just get her in assisted care? How can we cut the costs here? I'm tired of driving down there. How can we, you know, deal with this from a distance? And my oldest daughter showed up and said, we need to do this humanely. We need to pay people fairly. We need to find the right people to be with her, and we need to honor her wishes. And so luckily, I had learned how to listen at this point, and I said, yes, and you're in charge. I couldn't pay me out of my mother's money, but I could pay my daughter out of my mother's money. And so she took over this whole thing, and she brought my brother back into the family, who'd been estranged for 40 years. She gave me roles that I could actually do that were humane and right for me to do. She dealt with caregivers, swaps, and legal stuff and insurance stuff. She dealt with all of that beautifully. She got a group of caregivers together who we're still in touch with 4 months later. My daughter will probably be in touch with them the rest of her life. These people loved my mother and showed me what there was to love about my mother, which I was unaware of, which was very cool. So my daughters have been a huge rescue for me out of this as well. But so ACA, that first meeting, I got listening and I got the 14 traits. And coming in, I came into like I did everything. I came in like a bullet fired into a trash can, just insane. I tried to do everything at once. I started the steps. I would have taken on a service role the first day if I could have. I wanted to do everything. I asked, I don't know, maybe 5 people to sponsor me, and they did not respond. So And I got it. Like, later on, I got it. Like, this guy shows up and he is nuts. You know, like, I'm all over the place. And I'm sure people, like, looking at me coming towards them are just like, I have some recovery. I would like some rest at the end of the day. And this guy looks like trouble. So it took a while. I went through this. I started on step one. I hit step two. I'm cruising along. I hit step three, and I realized at that point that I had some gifts coming in. My wife being the biggest gift, my children. I had just as I came into ACA, I had started recording music for the first time, and I had this team out of nowhere that was professional and wonderful. I'd gone in to like record songs like as if I were going to do some hokey little thing for the family, like a one little CD that, you know, print 12 of them and hand them out at Christmas and then be embarrassed. But there were people in this room that were really, really good, and they transformed the music into something beyond belief. And I now have a producer that's like worked with Steve Perry. I'm just like, I'm stunned. But these were gifts that I had coming in. I also had the gift of this other program that I'd done, the Conversation Toward Autonomy, which taught me how to work hard at my therapy. And so I began 2.5 years ago doing the step work every morning with a structure, and I'm still using that same structure now. I go through step 10, I do the daily reading, I read 2 or 3 other books that are related, not directly. I allow my higher power to kind of pick those books out. And then I go to the step work and I do the work. And that structure has been stabilizing and has made me sane. And the other aspect of that work ethic that I brought in was that I began doing service as soon as I could. I did find a sponsor. Thank you. Thank you. I know you're out there. Which was just awesome. I came to the meetings, I shared, I did everything that the book said to do, because those were my instructions. And part of the step three for me, the first time through the step three, was that's who I decided my higher power was just going to be the instructions. It was going to be the big red book. It was outside of me. I knew that it needed to be outside of me. And so I just picked the big red book as my higher power. I think I'm going a little long on time, so I'm going to kind of draw this together here. I just want to talk a little bit about my experience with my co-sponsor. I really want to honor him. When he said yes, I don't know what his experience of me was. He has got lots of years and lots of programs. He's been through the steps many times. I don't know what I expected, but he gave me as much leash as I needed. He let me run. The steps and the structure would draw us back in and keep us on track. But when I wanted to go do the laundromat book in the middle of the seventh step, he just said yes. So we went and did the laundromat book in the middle of the seventh step. When I wanted to go explore something else, he just let me. I was able to dissipate an immense amount of energy through this co-sponsorship, just express all the stuff that was going on for me to one person who kept the continuity with me, who understood what I was going through, who truly bonded with me, who I truly love. I can't say enough about that experience. That was a huge experience for me to have that in my life. So the last thing I'd like to quote is actually a song that I wrote after that experience. I'll try to keep it together a little bit. It's not emotional, but I am emotional at the moment. So I'm just, it's called Riders on the Wind. You might find me on any path at all, eyes remote, riding tall. I have always known where my destiny would fall, but we all have to wait for that call. So for me, that call was ACA. I have gathered my compadres around me. Together we have learned how to ride free. We've burned everything just to see. the shimmering of that sharp destiny. We're riders on the wind, saving our own souls, not trying to fit in anymore. We're living in our skins, even if we play the fool. And if we leave, we're leaving by the door. So I'm experiencing, as I hit the 12th step, it felt like I was hitting a hairpin curve, because it's, you know, like, yes, go out and do service, go out and give what you've learned to the world and to other adult sufferers. At the same time, it says, you know, let's reevaluate where you've been and how you've done. And so when I hit the 12th step, that was a huge reassessment for myself, and I had to admit there was a bunch of stuff in ACA that I didn't do. So I didn't do things like aphorisms. I didn't do inner child work. I didn't think about critical parent. I certainly didn't talk about or think about unconditional love. I wasn't there yet. And my higher power was this cobbled together thing that worked for me, but it wasn't a higher power. You know, if I read step three now, they're talking about stuff that my higher power was not doing. And so as I go back through the steps now with co-sponsors, I'm feeling very excited to be going through it again. I don't put my writing into the yellow book, because I want to go through it clean each time, because it's going to be, for me, it's just radically different now. I've forgiven my family to a very large extent. I haven't had any energy on them, any negative energy on them now for like this year. It's been 5 months of no negative energy about my family. I just got to say, like, to me, the greatest gift so far has been that I've gotten outside my cage. I don't know where I can grow from here. I don't know what that means. I don't know where I'm going. I don't really care. And the inflammation that was my life is much less inflamed now. So I think a lot of my behavior, a lot of my misery came out of just being very sick, like literally like an inflamed joint, swollen with anger and rage and frustration. And that has dissipated so much in the last 2.5 years. And now I am calm. I don't have very many goals anymore. And the goals that I do have, I just keep throwing away. Every time I realize I have a goal, I just go, let's get rid of that one. And I am at this point now seeking to just become less self-reflective, like just have less attention on myself. Like just, you know, like just be more here, more now, and less me. So thank you for having me. This has been amazing. I'm so grateful for this group, so grateful for everyone I know here and everyone I don't know here. It's just, unbelievably, like, this is a great, stable, safe place to be. Thank you.